Hello, everyone. Welcome to Random Encounter 292 or 292. My name is John O'Logan, and I am taking some time off from playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. As you may have heard a few weeks ago, we did our special Random Encounter episode focused on Rebirth with Zach. And just before that, I had played Remake for the first time. And I thought about it, and I said, you know what? I could wait a few years until whatever the third game comes out, and then I could play Rebirth like I did with Remake. And then I thought, on the other hand, I have an odd feeling that the end of this is going to get spoiled for me, and I would prefer that not to happen. So I decided to play Rebirth. My review thus far, it's pretty damn good. I'm enjoying it. I'm really enjoying the story, enjoying the changes in the way they've changed the sequence of events, the way they developed character relationships. The relationship between like Barret and Red, I just love it. It's great. They're like a grumpy cop duo. It's fantastic. Don't like it as much as Remake. I don't think it's as good a game. I think that some of the side quests are real half-baked, and some of them have some of the most frustrating mechanics I've ever dealt with in a video game before, including like this. Well, first off, the reprise of the stupid gym mini games where it doesn't matter. You can do it perfectly, but you can still lose. That kind of stuff drives me crazy in video games, but just other, not sub stories, I'm too much Yakuza, side quests and things like the chicken wrangling mini game and a few of the challenge battles in the virtual fighting. The balance isn't quite there yet, and it doesn't look as good. It's still very good. I would give it like upper end of 80, probably 87, maybe 88. Don't know if I give it an editor's choice, but then again, I didn't review the game. So I'm enjoying it. I'm going to continue playing it. Hopefully I'll find out what happens. I'm at Cosmo Canyon right now, so hopefully, you know, whatever happens will happen pretty soon. And I will then be spoiler-proof, at least until the next game comes out in, theoretically, 2028. I'm not the only person on this podcast, though, who has played some video games over the last little while. Two of them are here with me today, and we're going to be chatting about one recent release that came out last week, and one that is something we don't usually cover, but this is, I think it's interesting enough that it warrants some attention. So first off, Joshua Lindquist, welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone.
And we also have Alex here. Hey, Alex.
Hello.
So, Josh, you usually cover a lot of retro games for RPG Fan. You are kind of my go-to when it comes to retro. And a few weeks ago, you messaged me with basically a pitch, saying why, extremely well thought out pitch about why you should be the person to be reviewing Unicorn Overlord. And it was completely unnecessary because I was going to give it to you anyway, but it was very, very thorough and thoughtful and made lots of really good points. And you absolutely blasted through this thing. It's a massive game. You blasted through it and we got a review up. And, I guess the spoiler is that you really enjoyed this game.
Yeah, no, I love it. I'm still playing it. I restarted it immediately after publishing the review. And I probably only saw...
That's the mark of a good one right there.
Yeah, probably only saw 60% of the content for the review just because there's so much extra side stuff to do that I could not get through in the time allowed. So I think there's still another 30 hours or so of side content I haven't seen quite yet.
And you will, obviously, because you are still playing and you are still very much enjoying it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about the reason why you wanted to review this game. And that is, well, Frank, to boil it down, you really, really, really love Ogre Battle.
Yeah, it's probably second only to Zelda in game series that I love. I don't know. It's strange. Like, I grew up playing Final Fantasy Tactics and all that also, but Ogre Battle's the one that really stuck with me, that I still play today. Like, I was playing it just days before Unicorn Overlord came out, and probably would be spending time this week playing it if I wasn't busy playing Unicorn Overlord. I've spent 24 years just digging into that game and finding every branching path and every just experimenting.
Well, before we dive into Unicorn Overlord, because Unicorn Overlord is, from all appearances and based on your review and what people have been saying, it is very much a spiritual successor to Ogre Battle. VanillaWare took Ogre Battle took this game that's well over 30 years old and they developed it into a spiritual successor, which is weird because no one's done it before. So before we dive into Unicorn Overlord, why don't you tell me what makes Ogre Battle different from other tactical RPGs of its time and today?
The big thing that makes it very obviously different is that there is no grid. An easy way to describe it just at a glance is take Fire Emblem and take away the grid, which then makes it more like a real-time strategy game where you direct units around a map in free movement, essentially. And then the second part that's different is that you don't command individual characters, you command squads or units that are essentially little mini RPG parties that you get to pick and choose which classes go in each. So in Unicorn Overlord, that's that you have up to 10 at once that you can send out groups of up to 5. So up to 50 characters in 10 groups that you are commanding all at once in a real-time with pause setup. So it's a hybrid of real-time and turn-based strategy. Because it still plays out in turn-based battles when you meet an enemy, which makes it just like Fire Emblem in that regard. Hmm. It's just a turn-based battle based on what your classes are, what your weapons are, and so on. But in the field, it's all real-time, and there are stage hazards to avoid. And it plays more like a real-time strategy game until you get into a turn-based battle, essentially.
Yeah, and then it takes on it's been a few years since I played Ogre Battle, but it feels a little bit like it looks a little bit like the combat system of like Suikoden, like that kind of perception, or Breath of Fire, that kind of thing.
Yeah, like from the perspective of the battle, how it looks, yes, for sure. You don't have the same direct control in the moment, which is off-putting to some people. It makes it seem like the game is just playing itself. But in reality, you have just made all those decisions earlier. And so you make the decisions, the battle begins, and your decisions are then represented on the screen.
Basically, it's the equivalent of you're a general and you are in your tent, like behind where the battle is happening, and you've sent out your orders. That's kind of what it feels like to me.
Exactly. Yep.
In that way, actually, it's a little bit more accurately representative of combat, really. At least not today, maybe, but back then, certainly. The developers of Unicorn Overlord are Vanillaware, and Vanillaware is, they've been releasing games for many, many years. The game that most people nowadays probably know them for is the 2019 game 13 Sentinels. And 13 Sentinels was a fascinating game. Irritatingly, it's only available on two systems, PlayStation and Switch. Vanillaware just does not seem very interested to release their games on PC. Which is weird to me because I imagine that would open up an entirely new audience, but whatever. One of the things that really defines Vanillaware is, well, frankly, their art style, which is very hand-drawn, gorgeous, gorgeous character art. And they tell some pretty damn good stories, and this game is no exception to that. Like, if you went into 13 Sentinels and you love 13 Sentinels and you play this game, you're going to recognize the style of graphics that you're going to be greeted with. I'm assuming that you were a giant fan of that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, like I've played Muramasa a long time ago and then played 13 Sentinels actually right after they announced Unicorn Overlord. I finally jumped in. I was already kind of on my radar, but it became a top priority to...
Oh, yeah, you got to see whether or not they're going to screw this up. All right, let's see if they're worthy of doing this. All right, fine. I guess they can still make it.
But yeah, it's like we were just talking about how the battle system of Ogre Battle, it looks like Suikoden. And like it's been so long since they made a game at all that even Ogre Battle 64 had 3D polygons, sort of, but it was kind of that style where they made a model and then almost like took screenshots and had little sprites of every angle. So it's still, it was still kind of primitive in its design, just the way it looked. Like Ogre Battle, The March of the Black Queen, it is not half as beautiful as Suikoden 2, for example. Like it just was never on that level. So to see this redone with Vanillaware style, even though it's just a totally different perspective, like just a from the side view with the hand-drawn art, it's just gorgeous to watch it all in motion. Just unlike anything this genre has ever had before.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that they've really gone back to this style of tactical RPG that really has been abandoned since the days of the Super Nintendo, so that's well over 30 years. One of the things that you didn't dislike it, but you found the story to be just kind of serviceable at the beginning. And then as it starts expanding, you find some of the smaller local stories considerably more interesting than the main plot.
Yeah, which was a little bit of a surprise coming off of 13 Sentinels, which I would put in like maybe even in a list of like top 10 video game stories ever written. It's like they put all their writers to work on that game and put all their system designers to work on this one. And so seeing that the main plot just wasn't quite up at that tier anymore is a little disappointing. But I think all of the individual characters are great. I can't think of a single character that I just flat out dislike. And they all have a story, and like we didn't dig into it in the review text, but there's actually an in-game library that documents everything you learn. Oh. Which is also kind of a throwback to Ogre Battle. Those games do have a big library of almost just like your like military archive of everything you've learned, right? And how all the points connect, who knows who, why that's important. And you have all of that. And from the moment a term gets brought up, a character, even if they were not shown on screen, it gets thrown into that library so you can go look up what you've learned about them. And so you get to learn all the little things about them. And it's like you meet family members of people that are on your in your battalion, or like the ex-fiance of someone shows up and, you know, oh, that person got kicked out of the military and I heard the story from my grandpa. you hear all of these things and how it all interconnects, and that you don't realize that everybody kind of has known each other. And part of that's your character has been away for 10 years. And, there's still kind of been not a full scale war, but sort of little pockets of rebellion happening during all that time. And so it makes all the characters feel alive, even though alive or part of a world, even though the main plot is just sort of like, can just call it an homage to a lot of older games, but it does just kind of feel like it's basic. It kind of boils down to you're the good guys and there's bad guys. Go kill the evil bad guy.
Good kingdom, bad kingdom. That kind of thing.
Exactly. And there's more to it. And even when I first played the demo, there early on in the story, there's a point where it's just like, oh, that seems like really lazy writing. Is that really what the game's just going to be? And you think you know exactly how it's going to play out. Thankfully, it did not just play out that simply. There were twists along the way that kind of changed your understanding. That just made it better, but it's still kind of an 8 out of 10 story. It's just, a 7 or 8 out of 10 story. It's just the world and the characters are what make it special rather than the main plot.
There's still a fair bit of character choice there, though, I imagine, in terms of like getting new recruits, like taking enemies in, because that was one of the coolest things I recall about Ogre Battle, which was, not all enemy units, but a lot of enemy units and a lot of enemy characters can become part of your army.
Yeah, I think the number is 63 characters. Mm-hmm. And unlike Ogre Battle or even like another recent game like Triangle Strategy, those games have lots of branching paths where a bunch of your decisions can like totally change who ends up in your party. Even like, oh, if you didn't recruit Saradin in Ogre Battle, then you're not going to get Destin later. Like, there was a lot of just deepness to one character can just roll over into several characters you just don't get. I don't think we have that in Unicorn Overlord. It seems a lot more basic where you might actually be able to get all 63 in one playthrough if you knew what to do. And you might make a decision where you just kill that character instead of recruit them. But you choosing to kill that character most of the time is not rolling over into you don't get these other characters either.
I've always thought an interesting mechanic, and I don't think I've ever seen this in a game, although it might, like, they'd be perfect for this kind of game, is you do have that option. Like, you can recruit enemy characters or you can execute enemy characters, but who you bring into your army will reflect the values of your army and your civilization. So if you were to, like the evilest bastard in the entire countryside, and you fight him and you invite him to join, wouldn't it be cool if that would actually change the character of your army on the whole and made them more vicious and unforgiving? And that could influence the ending based on who is on your side by the end of the game.
Right. I agree. I don't think anything has ever done it to that extent. Ogre Battle dabbles in those ideas where all of your characters have alignment, you know, like they're lawful, neutral, chaotic, and that determines what their what class they can be. But also, especially in the Super Nintendo game, you sort of have a bigger swaying mechanic of, oh, we're all kind of very evil, so the majority of my army, because of the way I'm fighting and killing everything and capturing every stronghold, everybody's kind of skewing toward that chaotic level. And that doesn't mean they take away your holy paladin that you already had, but if you choose to class change your paladin into a wizard, he's not changing back. And then both of the, both Ogre Battle and Ogre Battle 64 have, a reputation meter, essentially. They call it Chaos Frame. I don't know why it's called that, but where you get a score at the end of the game that determines what ending you get. And a lot of that stuff is where you're kind of, you're evil. Both of those games have stories where basically the leadership comes and says, thank you for saving us, but you're too dangerous to be left alive. And and it ends with them killing you off.
Thanks.
So like Ogre Battle dabbled in all of that. I don't think Unicorn Overlord is going to go there. I do think there's probably alternate endings that I haven't seen, but I don't think it's been long enough for us to really figure out all the ins and outs of that.
I have faith that you will see those endings. Well, we've covered the look, we've covered the story. How does it sound? What's the music and the, I guess, voice acting like?
So the music to me just doesn't stand out very much. It stands out at the beginning. The opening of the game is very interesting because it just drops you into basically a scripted battle that you can see in the demo, right? It's the first moments of the game that is kind of the last stand of your mother before you get spirited away off to hide in an island till you grow up.
So we're doing a Lufia off the top, really.
Sure. Yeah. And like you just get hidden away, but you get to play as your mother and see the final battle. And in that you get to see what a fully promoted, like max level unit kind of looks like. And to show you what you're working toward, that stage has probably the best song in the whole game, which kind of sets the bar a bit high in the moment, because you're like, wow, this is just great. And then it feels like, I'm sure that song plays again in the final battle or something, and I just didn't pay attention. But it kind of feels like it drops off after that, and that they just put the best song at the beginning. There are other songs that I like. It's not like it's the only good song. It just isn't. It doesn't feel like a classic soundtrack we're all going to be listening to forever. It just is a good soundtrack, you know.
A workmanlike does the job soundtrack.
Yeah, I do think there are some deliberate throwbacks to Ogre Battle themes periodically, even just in a choice of instrument or they play a specific chord. But even that's just kind of a few, and those are the kind of things that only somebody that's played Ogre Battle or even Tactics Ogre, because it shares a lot of the same music, played it a lot, would pick up on. The voice acting, I think, is the opposite story. I think the voice acting is great. Like, I'm not the biggest voice acting critic. You know, I can point out when voice acting is really, really bad, but there are times where everyone is criticizing a game and I'm just like, I don't see a problem with it. I think this is genuinely good performances. I've heard a lot of great things about FF7 Rebirth, and those performances being incredible, they're probably not that level of incredible. But but I think they've done a great job. Most of the stuff is voiced. They've got support conversations just like Fire Emblem. They didn't voice those. So that was a little bit of a bummer, but all of the big story scenes are voiced. And a lot of the characters that you go into battle with, have dialogue with bosses. So if you send in Joseph, you might get special dialogue that you wouldn't have gotten if you had just sent some random mercenary you picked up. And they voiced all of that. And I think it all turned out great. I'm really happy with how it sounds. I don't like skipping the cutscenes.
Understandably. That's neat. So I would say that we've gone through the graphics, the story, the sound. The thing that we want to really talk about here when it comes to this game, because there's just so much of it, are the systems. Because there are systems upon systems upon systems in this game, to the point where when I read your first draft of the review, you were really getting into it about the systems, because there were so many, just so many, and not just like for fun. Like, it seems like a dense system that you really need to get into to learn how it all works, while still being somewhat user friendly. If you don't want to get into those systems, you don't necessarily have to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm not even sure if I've told you this yet, but like, I woke up after writing that first draft of the review just thinking, oh wow, I forgot to mention this, and then I forgot to mention this, and there were multiple things like, it's already so much, I'm just gonna have to leave it behind. But there were things that just felt important, because every choice you make in the menus feels so impactful. And that's because you get to choose all of the skills, the equipment, the formations of every individual character. And like I said, 63 characters, but that's just the unique characters. Like, you can recruit and should recruit generic mercenaries of every class. You know, they're only going to give you one wizard for free. If you want to have more than one wizard, you've got to go hire them. You know, they're giving you a lot of these characters just to introduce classes, of which there are like over 70.
I mean, just right there, 70 classes, that's a lot of systems.
Yeah, and like some of that is that, you know, say 30 classes or so have a promoted version, right? So you've got a Griffin Knight and a Griffin Master. They're very similar, but one does more stuff and, you know, it's just better in the end. But yeah, it's over 70 classes in the end. A lot of unique classes where you only get one, and just it can be overwhelming, even just the possibilities. But when you're really, I'm really into those kind of systems where I can just pick everything and spend 3 hours managing the formations. If you're not into that, there's just an optimize button. You know, you still have to put them in a formation. It won't optimize that for you, but it will optimize their equipment and their skills, and all of that for you if you don't want to do it. You just have to decide, you know, who stands next to who. But the intricacies of how skills interact with each other and how the placement in your formation, which is a 2x3 grid, determines who you attack in the enemy formation, or maybe who you attack first and then who you attack on your second attack, or who you attack if there's a flying unit or if there's a rogue. You can choose every little detail and say, well, the rogue is weak to this arrow attack, so I really need to only use it if there's a rogue. And if there's a knight, then I need to prioritize the magic attack to take out the armor. There's a huge game of rock, paper, scissors happening with like 30 variables to it. So you have to decide all those little things. And then you get into that Pokemon type system where, well, that's an armored type and a magic type. So how do we find the weakness that does both? Or is it weak to both, or is it only weak to one of them? And so you get to play that whole game, which encourages you to just constantly be changing your army. You can't just make it once and say, this is my team that's going to win everything, because it won't. I was changing my formation up to the very last moments of the game. Like, I was unable to finish the game with the formations I took into the final stage. I had to just stop for 30 minutes and rearrange it, because I was not winning.
The thing about that is you get to see the terrain before you fight, and that allows you, I imagine, to pick specific troops to fit the terrain. There are other elements that play into that. For example, in the review, you say there can be siege weapons, there can be weather effects, stage-specific elements that do surprise you. So that's an interesting level of, okay, you can prepare, but you better be ready because stuff's going to happen that you're not ready for.
Right. And it is true that you usually get to see the terrain if you want to. There are times mm-hmm. you kind of get surprised where just from a story perspective, it doesn't make a lot of sense for you to be able to, you know, just run circles around some major enemy stronghold right before you lay siege to it, right? So at a certain point in each kind of chapter of the story, there'll be spots that are off limits. But for the most part, the battles play out just in the overworld that you explore. And because of that, you can just explore the overworld ahead of time.
Yeah, exploration seems to be a big thing in this game, more so than a lot of other strategy RPGs.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever played a strategy RPG with exploration like this. It's almost always just, you know, click a point on a map. Here's your next battle. Oh, you finished that battle?
It's very much like the general in the tent looking at a map down and you say, we're going here.
Exactly. And yeah, it's like, you know, if you're real lucky, you play a game, it's like, oh, you finished that one. Here's three options. Do you want to do these side ones? Or maybe it's actually three different paths and this permanently changes your decisions. But it's never just, here's a Final Fantasy VI overworld, go run around. You know, and that's maybe not even the best example. It was just kind of the first overworld that came to mind.
Yeah.
Because it is scaled down like that, where there's little towns and your little character is as big as all the buildings, right? But there's just a lot more to do in the overworld than in most of those classic overworlds. Just stuff to find, little secret side quests. There are enemies to fight in places you haven't actually liberated yet. And so I have on multiple occasions now spent an hour or more exploring the overworld before I went on the next fight.
Yeah, which is actually fun. At least I think so. I mean, one of my favorite things about this, you know, RPGs is exploration, exploring. To be honest, it's one of the reasons why strategy RPGs have never entirely clicked with me. Because I like the puzzle aspect. I love the figuring out the battles, but it's always just one after the other, after the other, after the other. And I miss the exploration that provides the connective tissue and context to those various battles.
Yeah, and I actually think that's a big part of maybe why they added this feature, because it does feel like they wanted to make a game with deep systems, but they wanted to keep it accessible to folks that wouldn't usually engage with that. And instead just... would give you an option to do something else, right? And so they gave you this overworld with little secrets to find and towns to rebuild, which is basically a mini quest log of get these five apples. We need these apples and these planks of wood to fix our town, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not like super meaningful, but you get good stuff for doing it. you just get a bunch of fun stuff to run around and look at.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the coolest things about Unicorn Overlord, from what I've heard, and you mentioned it earlier, is that there's a demo, and it's not just a quick demo. It's a pretty substantial chunk of content, and that will... Here's the thing. I think that this, from what it sounds like, this is a phenomenal game. I don't necessarily think it is for everybody. And that 10-hour demo is going to really give people a chance to see if it's for them. And if it is, it will draw them in and not let them go.
Yeah, I would say 10 hours is a bit of a long, a bit of a stretch. It's not impossible. So the demo has a 5-hour timer.
10 hours for you.
Sure. The 5-hour timer only counts when you're actually like engaging in the overworld, engaging in a mission. If you just sit in the menus, the timer stops.
Okay.
So the time you spend trying to figure out your army and stuff, it doesn't count that, which has, like, I played the demo twice before we had access to the full game, and other folks have played it several times. And it's incredible the amount of content you could go to, because the overworld gives you such a free roaming area. you could say, well, this time I'm going to go south, and next time I'm going to go north, and next time I'm going to go east. And I mean, the internet had explored a larger part of this game before I ever had access to it. Just because they had dug so deep into a demo that was only supposed to be 5 hours. But then they let you, like, the timers, even like it's per file. You can just make more files and more files. And you can save whenever you want, including in the middle of a mission, which is a really awesome quality of life feature. And if you had a 3 hour left on your timer and you just saved, you could just reload that save 2 hours later and walk a different way instead. And then it all transferred to the full game. Like, it's one of the best demos I have ever played.
That's really, really cool and extremely generous in terms of giving people all of that free content to see, is this going to click with me?
There's roughly 10% or 15% of the game maybe accessible.
And you feel that it's roughly representative of the game as a whole.
Absolutely. Yeah, like it gives you so many options of where to go and access to maybe a third of the classes.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a lot. If you could just sit and play the demo for the next 2 weeks and keep seeing new content.
And then play the game for quite some time, because it sounds like there's a ridiculous amount of replay value here.
Yes, I think so. If you're really, really into strategy games, but you're not really into replaying them just to see, if you're really into it for the story more than the strategy, mm-hmm. there's maybe not tons there. Or if you're tons of replay value, or if you're the kind of player who's like, I'm going to find the very, very best team, and I don't really care about trying anything different. This is the one that GameFAQ says is the best. I'm just going to use this. There's probably not a lot of replay value in it. If you like to tinker with it and just try different things, you'll find just really cool stuff you can do, and you'll be playing it forever.
That is wonderful, actually, and somewhat rare when a game offers that kind of experience. And I'm glad that you may not have had a replacement for Ogre Battle, but at the very least, something to play alongside it whenever you feel like playing a strategy RPG.
Yeah, I'm very, very happy about it too. It's much easier to play this on my Switch than to pull out an N64 or even just an emulator or whatever to play any of the old ones. They are not readily available.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a point in its favor. It's gorgeous. It's a beautiful looking game. And I think that Vanillaware has been putting out some very interesting titles over the last few years, and it does not look like they are going to stop, because the game has been doing extremely well from all signs, in Japan especially, where I believe they sold out of all physical copies.
I had not heard that, but I'm glad to hear it.
So hopefully it's doing similarly well here in North America and the West. Well, Josh, thank you very much obviously you wanted to play this game. Nothing was going to stop you from playing this game. I'm really, really glad that you got an opportunity to write about it, because it's really quite a compelling review. And despite the fact here's the thing, Josh, I read a lot of reviews, and for our site and for other sites too. One of the hardest things to do is when you just love a game, you just love it to death and you're playing the heck out of it. One of the hardest things to do is to be objective. And you clearly love this game. You gave it a 92. Like, you didn't give it 100. You see its flaws pretty clearly, and you love it anyway. And in many cases, maybe because of those flaws. I think it's a great review. And I think that if anyone out there enjoyed Ogre Battle as a child or as an adult, and you want a modern experience that will resonate with that, Unicorn Overlord sounds like just a perfect, perfect title.
Yeah, I would take it a step further and say that if you love Fire Emblem, at least get mm-hmm. the demo and give it a shot. There's a lot of Fire Emblem DNA here, even though, yep. and even just deliberate throwbacks to Fire Emblem. Like, the support system, they call it the rapport system, is literally just Fire Emblem's support system. If you love Fire Emblem, give it a shot. Especially if you're into Fire Emblem for the strategy and not just the story.
Incidentally, when I say that this is a perfect title, I'm referring to the game itself, not the actual title. The joke I've been making is Unicorn Overlord sounds like it sounds like the username of like an alpha male on Tinder. Like, it's the most overly suggestive, ridiculous name of a game since, well, frankly, Triangle Strategy.
Yeah, I don't want to to keep us dwelling on it too long, I will just say the name makes sense. Like, the unicorn is established very, very early in the story as, like, a deity, essentially, that it's this world's religious kind of thing they worship as, like, a power for good. So, like, they established that in, like, the first moments of the game, the holy unicorn. That's where the title came from. Unicorns are supposed to be really cool and powerful in this world. That's what they are.
Yes.
And don't judge it based on the name entirely.
Don't dig any deeper. There it is. Well, one of the things that we were talking about earlier in this conversation was the idea of there being kind of a morality system built in based on the choices that you make throughout. And in the last, I'd say, decade or so, many titles have been exploring morality systems. But I would argue that the most successful one and the one that sort of subverts that entire thing is a little indie RPG called Undertale. So Undertale was a 2015 indie RPG heavily inspired by the Mother series created by Toby Fox, who nowadays is just beloved for his Undertale, Deltarune, and for his music. But when this game got released, Toby Fox was really known just for his Earthbound hacks, of which there are very many. So Earthbound fan games, essentially. And he decided to make his own game, one that was very heavily inspired by the style of Mother, but entirely its own thing. And in doing so, Toby Fox took the video game world by storm. Even if you've never played Undertale, I suspect that you are more than aware of a lot of the characters and jokes and certainly the music. And it's beloved. People love this game. And since then, as I said, Toby Fox has gone on to create Deltarune, which is a spiritual successor, featuring some of the same characters, I believe, but taking a very different tact on the scenario. And fans wanted more. So what fans do in this situation. So they create essentially fan fiction, fan art. Because it's a video game, they decided to make a fan game. So Undertale Yellow was released just a few months ago and by a team called Team Undertale Yellow, rather appropriately. And Toby Fox was not involved with this fan game at all. However, they did receive his blessing when they first started on this project in 2016. So this game has been in development for a good many years now, and it's good, apparently. Like, it's not just a fan game. It's very, very, very good. It feels like a successor to its original title in many, many ways. Alex, you recently played this, and you wrote a feature called Undertale Yellow Feels Like a Legit Prequel, and it's a fascinating feature for a number of reasons, not just because it's talking about a prequel to Undertale, but also because you talk a lot about fan games in it, fan game culture, what fan games can be, and your own perspective on it, and how this title may have changed your perspective on it.
Yeah, it certainly did. I was like never really drawn to the idea of playing a fan game. I guess like just in my general consumption of like books, movies, games, I've gravitated towards like auteur like visionaries, like Hideo Kojima, Yoko Taro, even like Sakaguchi to an extent, Yuji Horii, just like individuals that I could like attribute a creative vision to and like trace that throughout all the products they put out, and see how they evolve with their work. Obviously, that's a little bit reductive, especially considering video games, like usually when they're handled by like very big development teams, like there's obviously that creativity is flowing from a bunch of different ways, and it works as like a feedback loop between a team rather than like just like a top down, like one person just creating the entire singular game vision and thinking of everything themselves. Like that's not how it works. There's systems designers coming up with their own things. There's narrative designers coming up with their own things. And all those things have to work together and the team has to communicate. So, I started not really being so attached to that idea anymore. And then, when I was teaching my narrative design class, at the end of the semester, it was like last December, we talked about Undertale in that class, and a couple of kids were like, oh, are you going to play like Undertale Yellow? I'm like, what the heck is that? And they're like, oh, it's like a fan game, but it's like really being pursued as like an authentic like prequel to the game. Like it looks like it's going to be really cool. And like I had known, like I really loved Undertale, and I got a bit into the Undertale lore rabbit hole after I played the game. I thought it created a fascinating world with a lot of gaps that it was cool to see people trying to explore and make sense of. But seeing like the different fan content that just would pop up on my YouTube feed, like it looked like really silly, clearly like taking like characters from Undertale and just putting them in like ridiculous things, especially like Sans was just everywhere and they're just doing ridiculous things with Sans. I also saw that there were like two other similar like idea fan games called Undertale Red and Undertale Green. I'm not sure how complete they are to this day, but I think both of those were also kind of just more ridiculous and playing with a lot of Toby Fox's properties and just kind of having fun with the property. But Undertale Yellow gripped me when I started looking into it more, of just being like, no, we are trying to make an authentic prequel. Like this is supposed to be a game that continues the legacy of Undertale, that respects everything it established, but also wants to build on that and flesh out that story. And so I think a key way that the developers do that here, and this isn't just like created by like one person either. I think the lead of the project goes by Master Sword Remix. I think I'm getting that right. But if you look at the credit list, it's like it goes down to like 20-ish people overall worked on the project, maybe even like some additional contributors. But it's a pretty robust team of people working on this game over 7 years. So they were working hard. They were trying to make sure that they respect the original vision of the game. And they did so. And one of the main ways they did that is just to not really include many of the main characters that Toby Fox had written as prominent characters in Undertale. So you don't really encounter characters like Sans and Papyrus and Undyne in this game. You do see Toriel for a bit at the very beginning, because the beginning like basically mimics Undertale. It's like, just like in the lore of Undertale, it's like seven children had fallen into the underground before the protagonist. And so this game fleshes out the story of the child that fell before, which was the yellow soul, because each of these children who eventually died and their souls were retained by the monsters in order to try to free the monsters from the underground where they are imprisoned and have been living for some time. So this is fleshing out the yellow soul, whose character trait is justice. I think they did a really great idea just trying to emulate the different ways that Undertale works, and we can get into more of those things, while also trying to very much imprint their own kind of creative voice on the game, and I think it turned out quite well.
Yeah, I mean, fan fiction is an interesting thing. Personally, I am a big fan of fan fiction. I read a lot of fanfic when I was growing up, specifically Back to the Future fan fiction by a writer named Kristen Shelley and another writer named Mary Jean Holmes. And these were like, not just in my years ago, I've read it as an adult, and like their work is top shelf. This could have been a licensed series that continued after the movie that you'd see on bookshelves. Like they were exceptionally good. And then again, you go online and you read a lot of terrible fan fiction, and that's no reflection. Like fan fiction isn't meant to necessarily be held up to the same quality as and standard as the actual works. It's for fun in a lot of cases. It's for a sense of creative expression using characters that have touched you and which you feel deeply connected to. Mm-hmm. And video games provide a very interesting, especially certain series, provide very interesting canvases of which you can paint. Because this is technically speaking, fan fiction. Yes, it's blessed by Fox, but it is fan fiction. I realize it's a video game, and because of that, it's a little bit weird. But the interesting thing about video games as compared to, say, a novella-length piece following Marty and Doc after Back to the Future Part 3, that doesn't have mechanics. That doesn't have game mechanics. It doesn't have, like, the same environmental storytelling. Mm-hmm. Video games are very, very different than fanfic. And in the case of this one, you talk a little bit about the story, and you say the story is good. It's fine. It almost, I guess, it echoes much of what Fox is doing without necessarily reaching the same levels of narrative brilliance and subversion of video game tropes that he does. Where you seem to be most impressed with this game, though, is in the mechanics and the way they pick up on the mechanics of Undertale. And in many cases, in some cases even, sounds like they improve them.
I definitely really enjoyed just the gameplay of this game. It feels great to play. For one thing, they added a sprint button, which just makes running through the different areas quickly.
Now that is a quality of life feature convenient. I can get behind.
Well, I will never say no to a sprint button. but from there, they run with it. From the first, like, new enemies you start fighting, there's creative new mechanics on hand. They're clearly just having fun with thinking of different, like, attack patterns and really just running with that kind of, like, bullet hell foundation of Undertale, where you control this little heart in this box, basically, and you're just dodging enemy attacks. And they express, like, the individualities of the different monsters you fight through just different attack patterns. And as might be expected, the epitome of where that really gets expressed is in boss battles. And there were just some really cool, conceptually fun boss battles in Undertale Yellow that were as good, if not better, than some of Undertale's boss battles. Like, a couple that come to mind would be, like, one where you're fighting against this luchador-like monster, and he challenges you to, like, a dance-off. And you go into the battle, and it basically turns the your little play box into, like, a Guitar Hero style rhythm game, where you have to position your heart under the right bar, and then as, like, all the note bars are, like, coming down on the screen, you have to, like, hit the button as soon as it, like, hits the little box at the bottom of your battle box. So that was a really fun one. Another one where you're fighting, like, this cowboy kind of character, because Undertale Yellow is very cowboy themed. Is that he actually...
You can't tell from the main character, yes.
Yeah. He actually lassos up your soul so that you're essentially always being pulled back to the center of the screen as you're trying to, like, move your heart around. Like, you can see, like, the tension of the rope giving way. And so, like, you're getting, like, shot at with, like, these cool gun attacks as you're trying to dodge them while still being, like, tied up. So it's there's really creative stuff here. And honestly, had a blast with it. I've already played the game 2 times, and I will sure be coming back for more.
We are deliberately avoiding really detailed spoilers, because while I imagine that most of the listeners out there are aware of Yellowtail's approach to narrative design, I don't want to spoil anything about it, because it is genuinely one of the greatest achievements in video games in video game history, arguably. Hmm. I only recently played it. It was so heavily inspired by Earthbound, and I could not beat Earthbound. For those listening, I think I've said this before. I dislike Earthbound. I don't know why. I wish that I liked it. I don't. I really, really don't. And because of that, I was a little bit nervous about coming into Undertale, because Undertale is directly inspired by the Mother series. And I didn't need to be worried. Undertale is just wonderful. It was such a wonderful experience. I played it a few weeks ago, just loved it. We're going to get into a little bit of spoiler territory here, but nothing specific about characters, which was the central conceit of Undertale is that there are a variety of routes that you can take to get to the various endings. There's 3 of them. There's the neutral route, there's the pacifist route, and there's the genocide route, where you can selectively pick who you spare or spare everyone, or alternatively just kill everyone that comes across you.
Well, I will just say for the genocide, it's important to emphasize that it's not you kill everybody you come across. It's that you hang around in every area until you kill every single living thing and there is nothing left to encounter.
Yeah. So basically like any other RPG, really. And that's part of the brilliance of the series is that I imagine that people going into this in the early days when they didn't know the central conceit and they just start playing it as a regular RPG. I mean, that is one hell of a statement. Mm-hmm. I knew exactly what I was doing when I went into it because it's been almost a decade. And because of that, I am aware. Now, I imagine that with Undertale Yellow, while there still is a, you know, still divided into the same structure, it's very, very faithful in that sense. Hopefully it does something a little bit different with it.
It's yes and no. I won't get into too many specifics, but it's very conscious that it's playing with the same structure as Undertale. And it makes sure that even though the tone of those routes aren't too different, that you are getting some like deviations in what it means for the story, what it means for your character's development, and ultimately just like how it all ends up playing out. That's pretty unspecific, but I will just say because in Undertale, the neutral route is like not really a fixed route. It's kind of just like a stepping stone because like I think with Undertale, it was very like it was expected that you would treat it as a regular RPG, especially if you didn't do any prior research into the game, if you were playing it fresh. So you would end up getting some kills, and so you would just default to the neutral route for your first playthrough. I think that's what Toby Fox expected most players would do. With here, the neutral route, they just added a bit more appeal to it by making kind of the last few hours of it pretty narratively distinct in terms of what happens, in terms of what you see. And there is a completely unique final boss to the neutral route that might be the best boss I've played in the game so far. So definitely don't skip out on the neutral route thinking it might be like unnecessary, as it could kind of be argued for in Undertale.
Mm-hmm. I think that, see, I understand your trepidation, especially about Undertale. You mentioned a line in this art feature that I just love is, if there's one main critique I'd raise against Undertale Yellow, it's that it turns what felt like a magic trick in Undertale into routine. That isn't the fault of the game's execution, but a natural consequence of creating a direct, faithful successor to such an original vision. And I feel like that's very true. There are some things that, frankly speaking, shouldn't have sequels for a variety of reasons. They just take something away from the original. Like, one of my favorite things in the world that actually reminds me a lot of Undertale is a cartoon miniseries called Over the Garden Wall, which similarly feels, it doesn't have the same tone as Undertale, but it creates this otherworldly sense and it subverts so many things that we take for granted in our narratives. It's just wonderful. And I would hate to see a sequel to Over the Garden Wall. And I think what Toby Fox has done with Deltarune is by creating alternate versions of the same characters and things like that, but putting in a different setting is telling a different story set, maybe not in that universe, but related to it. Whereas this is a direct follow-up. Mm-hmm. Or I guess it's a follow-up in the sense that it's a prequel. And that's tricky. That's I don't know about that.
That's exactly how I felt going into it. Again, I wasn't too impressed with just like the premise alone when I looked into it. It was just like word of mouth of like a number of people I respect just being like, no, it's really actually good. That was like, all right, fine, I'll give it a shot. Just because I was such a huge fan of the original game. So even if I wasn't like impressed with everything it did, I was just like, okay, if it gives me just like the Undertale gameplay satisfaction even, then I'd be impressed with it. But it ended up doing even more than that. It did its own thing with the story, even though it definitely did feel a little redundant. I'd say like the worst part of the redundancy might have actually been in the reused like levels. Even though the first two levels in Undertale were the Ruins and Snowdon. mm-hmm. which is like an underground cave area and a snowy area, your classic video game snow level. And while they don't look the same and sound exactly the same in Undertale Yellow, at first I was a little unimpressed, being like, am I really just like going through the same zones again? And I was just like, okay, game, when are you going to like start introducing some new things? And I was having fun with the gameplay all this time, but then I started to get to some more unique zones, and the story started to go in even more unique directions. So I was just like, okay, you're a good game. and a good follow-up, despite the odds being stacked against it, honestly.
Mm. I mean, God knows, the central conceit of the game being the different colors of souls. And it sounds like other people have done things like that. Like, that's a really good idea for a series of prequels. I think one of the things I'm most relieved about this is, we were talking, I think we're going to mention this in the discussion question in a second, but one of the things about, like you said, video games is that oftentimes series are not developed by the same people. I mean, BioShock and BioShock 2 are two simple, you know, they're, one's a direct follow-up, but it's directed and created by very, very different people, mm-hmm. With a different point of view. But this game, Toby Fox specifically, it was his. This was mm-hmm. his thing. And yes, I understand that there were a few other people in there who helped with character designs and things like that, but it was very much, it was a one man, it was an auteur, very similar. I felt, how can I put this? When I first heard of your the feature, you came to me, I believe you asked if we could do a review of it. And I was like, well, it's a fan game. I don't know if we can do a review of a fan game or not, but I still think it's a great idea to cover. I was suspicious of it, not because I think fan games are bad, because I don't. I think fan games are amazing, but it's because it was a singular story. It felt very similar to me as to after Douglas Adams died, when Owen Colfer was hired to write the official sixth book in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series and another thing. And I was like, at the time, even before I read it, I was like, what's this? This feels wrong. This actually feels 100% morally wrong. And then I read it and I was like, well, that was horribly mediocre. It felt like a half decent impression of a singular voice, but that's all it felt like. I have complicated feelings about and another thing, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy 6. But that was my concern when I heard about this. And it sounds like they've done something similar, but been much more successful in it. In that it does feel a bit like an imitation, but a loving one. There's nothing, it doesn't feel like it. Well, you mentioned here, it's not cynical. It doesn't feel cynical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. In general, like I think the two most distinct stamps of Fox's authorial voice in Undertale were in the writing, which was often like laugh out loud funny. And in the music, which was just like universally beautiful and well composed and like hit hard and like great dance tunes, great emotional tunes.
Megalovania is the only thing you know from Undertale. You owe it to yourself to listen to some more music from Undertale.
Yeah, absolutely. That soundtrack is definitely one of my favorite that's ever been in a game, for multiple reasons. So in both of those two departments, it definitely feels like imitation. It feels like loving imitation. It doesn't quite reach those standards, especially the writing itself. Like I didn't like the writing wasn't like eye-rollingly like it didn't make my eyes roll much or anything like that. They didn't use like Toby Fox's characters. They didn't step on his toes too much. So they create a few distinct characters that have their own kind of personalities that are written in their own ways and that mostly work pretty well and are charming in a very Undertale-ish way. Just not quite as infectious in terms of the writing, in terms of the humor especially. The music, I will say, I give it like a bump up over the writing. Like the music also doesn't quite reach Fox's amazing standard, but it's really good. Like this soundtrack is very good, even if you don't play the game, and you should. If you like Undertale, you should absolutely play this game. then that mm-hmm. soundtrack still has like a lot of great stuff going on, especially with the Wild West themed level. You get a lot of great like cowboy tunes, almost like giving like a Wild Arms-esque feel. And I love me some Wild Arms music, so that was just a great thing to experience.
Yeah, if I was listening to this podcast and I was curious about this game, the first thing I would do is head on YouTube and go watch the launch trailer for this, because it involves you're going to get a taste of the music, but it also involves a really, really awesome animated little sequence that just looks gorgeous and kind of encapsulates a lot of what Undertale is. And this thing was made with love. There's nothing cynical about this, which is wonderful, because I feel like, obviously, here's the beautiful thing about fan fiction. There's terrible fan fiction, but I don't think it's cynical, because there is no profit motive in it. It's for the love of the thing. Mm-hmm. And frankly speaking, when you have a love of the thing, even something that is not super high quality is going to have something at its heart. In my opinion, I might not want to read it or play it, but there's something there at its heart that feels honest and innocent and true.
And if any series would fit well with kind of just like an open-hearted, sincere, earnest approach to developing it further, like it would definitely be Undertale, which just has like a heart of gold.
Yeah, very much. In this case, literally, soul of gold. Well, I want to move on to our discussion question now, and we're going to base this off of what our conversation we just had, which was fan games. So I realize that with complete understanding that game development is a grueling and time-consuming process, and not everybody has the time or the patience or the skills to do it, or the drive. I mean, you really have to want to do this. If you want to be a game developer, it needs to be your life. All of that being said, I just have a question for both of you, and I'll answer it myself after. If you were to design a fan game, what series would you choose and why would you choose it?
I mean, this is a similar case to Undertale, actually, where it's just like, if anybody actually tried to do this, I'd have like extreme skepticism towards the fact that they're doing it. Mm-hmm. But I would just pursue this one just for my own enjoyment, basically, in terms of like developing it. I would probably do a fan game for Disco Elysium.
Ooh, that is a... Yeah, that's...
I'd probably never release it to the world, but... like, for one, the original creators are unfortunately never going to be able to make another one anyways, because they were essentially ran out of their own company. So they're now detached from the IP they put so much love and work into, which sucks. So they're not going to do it. So I could step in and give it a shot. I wouldn't want to heavily feature any of the characters that they had in Disco Elysium in kind of a similar way that Undertale Yellow didn't. I think that's a great move if you're trying to make an authentic, canonical feeling fan game. But just for my own enjoyment, like Disco Elysium is just like heavily writing based. I would just like love to, just write a bunch of dialogue that has to do with that world, with all its like really interesting spiritual elements, historical elements, political elements. There's just so much to dig into there. There's like a ton of different places with rich histories described in Disco Elysium that you never actually get to see, because when you play that game, you actually only see like an extremely small part of that world. So there's tons of already existing lore that you could kind of just like pick another place and dive into there and see what it might be like, what it might look like, and what the people there might be like. And also, I think it would be just fun to explore more aspects of those kind of inner character voices you're wrestling with, and to do so with like a different protagonist, and think about like what will those voices maybe sound like for a different protagonist. And maybe even think up some new ones, because if it was just the same ones, that'd be a little boring. But I think I'd have fun with that.
Neat. Josh, how about you?
I'm going to go more retro, as is kind of my thing. So I really, really love The Legend of Zelda.
I was going to put all of my money on Legend of Zelda.
But also, I love turn-based combat a lot more than I like any Zelda combat. Mm-hmm. And the series that crosses those two things the best is unfortunately also dead. I don't know why I like so many series that no one wants to make any new games for. And that's Lufia.
Yes.
I could also call out like Golden Sun is a nice middle ground there, because I love the turn-based combat and having a party and teaching them spells and managing all their equipment. But I also really like having a hookshot. Like when I used to, as a kid, just like want to design things, like I used to just even just draw maps, right, and make my own guides mm-hmm. before I could put them on websites. And the thing that that I got fascinated by was designing an overworld and designing little puzzles inside of caves. And like, mm-hmm. I distinctly remember even like Golden Sun, I loved those stupid little puzzles where you hop across the stones and mm-hmm. how you could hop in the wrong way. And now it's like a maze. I loved that. So, but Lufia 2 in particular also just has these insane puzzles that I still have to look up if I'm going to replay that game, because I just my brain's not there for it. But I could impose that on someone else. I'll design the puzzles that people have to look up the answers to.
There are a lot of, I mean, not so much for Disco Elysium, but for Zelda, there are tools out there to help you create your own Zelda games.
Yes.
I believe Zelda Classic.
Yeah, Zelda Classic has been around for 25 years.
Yeah, it's essentially, it's been 25 years. It's essentially Mario Maker for the original Legend of Zelda.
Yeah, there are some others and whole communities built around those Zelda fan games. I used to draw little sprites for them. This is like 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago. I used to just draw little sprites and put up little sheets so you could, you know, have your favorite Majora's Mask character, but drawn in a Link to the Past style.
Yeah, I mean, there were some phenomenal Legend of Zelda fan games out there, both ROM hacks and originals. I mean, as I understand it, I think it's canceled at this point, but the 2D Ocarina of Time.
Oh, yeah, that's been started up and canceled probably by 30 different teams at this point.
Yeah,
there was the original that was like went viral before we even called it that, and everyone was excited about. There's also there's a tool that got renamed. I can't even remember the original name, but it became such like a legit game making tool that they kind of took the Zelda out of it, and it's just mm-hmm. called Solaris now. But it does make Zelda likes, and at least one game called Ocean's Heart has been published on platforms. Like, you can buy it on the Switch, but it was made in what is essentially a Zelda Maker just tool. So yeah, if you want to make Zelda fan games, there's great tools for that, just like you could make an RPG with RPG Maker, right? And there's also like a Fire Emblem Maker. So there's stuff out there to make it. If you're just bored one weekend and you want to make a something, you could probably build a dungeon.
You know? I mean, again, that's how Toby Fox got his start, was making fan games for Earthbound. And I mean, there are other ways of making fan games as well. Fan hacks are very important things, but also they like the Zelda Parallel Worlds, I imagine, would be the one that most people would be most familiar with in terms of using the Link to the Past engine to create a brand new game. I mean, I'm not surprised, Josh, that you are interested in Zelda, but Lufia is an interesting idea. I wish someone would get back to Lufia, because it's a solid property, at least the first two. For me, and this isn't necessarily because of the story, although I do love the story and the designs of it. For me, it might be Chrono Trigger. And the reason why is because I love time travel as a narrative mechanic. I always have. Cause and effect is something that I feel is lacking in a lot of narrative, and in time travel narratives, it's everything. And I would like to see a Chrono Trigger 3, I guess, explore that a little more. Like, I would like to, in the original game, for example, most famously, I would argue the best example of it is there's a selfish mayor who has something you need. You go back in time, teaches ancestors altruism, you go back to the future, and the mayor is, it just gives you the item out of the goodness of his heart. I would like to see that, but on scaled up in ways both big and small. Like, I like the idea of butterfly affecting. You talk to somebody in the past, and all of a sudden their future descendant has something different to say. Not even like in a consequential way, just like in a way that when you're back there, you're actually having an impact on things that you don't even, you wouldn't even realize. I like that idea. And I think that any future iteration of Chrono, providing, of course, that it uses time travel as a central mechanic, should explore that. Mind you, I don't know if, first off, there will ever be a third iteration of the Chrono series, because it certainly seems like Square Enix is not interested in doing so. But also, I mean, Chrono Cross featured parallel realities. Where else could they go? I don't know. They don't seem to want to retread. Anyway, that's an interesting thing. It's what, Alex, what I found interesting about your answer is the idea of, and this is what I think is smart for fan games and also for actually media in general. I think telling another story that takes place in a world but unrelated to the characters that we came to know is a really smart way of creating a follow-up to something, because it allows you to explore, as long as you have an interesting world, it allows you to explore that interesting world. I think that's a cool concept. And actually, I would argue that that concept is directly responsible for the popularity of the Marvel Cinematic Universe in its early days, is that it was all taking place in the same world, but every single movie was telling its own story, featuring its own character. These movies were not sequels of each other. They just happened to be taking place in the same world. And that's probably one of the reasons why the MCU has been struggling in the last few years, is because every single project that comes out now feels like a sequel to every other project. So it's lost that feeling of shared universe, but not, you don't necessarily need to do your homework before going into each movie. Sorry, I went off on a little tangent there about the MCU.
And it feels like the universe has been built already too.
Arguably it has, but I mean, there's a lot of room to explore in the MCU. The original Marvel universe has been going on steadily since the 1960s to greater and lesser effect. So I would argue there's still lots of room to develop in the MCU. I just don't think that they are executing as well as I think they need to now in order to survive in the current media landscape of, and I hate this term, superhero fatigue. Okay, I'm just going to talk about this for a minute because this has been on my mind lately. I think superhero fatigue is bullshit. I think it's complete and utter horseshit. I think the media has been talking about superhero fatigue for the last 15 years. Every single time an MCU movie comes out, the word superhero fatigue is in that review. It drove me crazy when it was happening. It drives me more crazy now. Superhero fatigue is not because the MCU is still releasing movies. It's because people are tired of crap. And unfortunately, the DC extended universe and a variety of other properties have been releasing crap, crap, crap. Constantly. Sony's been doing it for years, and they've been diluting the Spider-Man IP because of it. And the reality is the average theater goer does not pay attention to whether or not something is Marvel or DC or Sony. They just think it's a Marvel movie or it's a comic book movie. I've watched all of the recent Marvel output. It's fine. It's actually fine. It's not brilliant, but it's fine. The problem is fine was good enough before the market got saturated with crap. Now it needs to be really good. It needs to be outstanding in order to rise above the crap. And the MCU just hasn't been executing on that level. But I don't think it's superhero fatigue. I think it's just the fact that a lot of superhero movies coming out from a lot of other companies have been crap, and they've been dragging down the bell curve.
Well, for Marvel in particular, I also feel like they dug a hole for themselves by building up to the epic climax that was like Infinity War and Endgame. So it just feels like, after that, it's just like, everything, like all these like 10 different movies that played up to this moment, like they all contributed to this moment, and we reached this moment, and now the moment is over. So now what, guys? So I feel like part of like the, especially like the increased use of superhero fatigue is also just post Endgame. It's just like, we reached the epic climax that all this Marvel stuff was supposed to build to. So how are we going to like raise those stakes again? How do we get people invested in the stakes that we have to offer now?
Oh, and I'm in no way, shape or form defending Marvel's choices over the last couple of years. I'm saying the product has been fine. I didn't say that that it was good. In a lot of cases, it hasn't been. It's just been okay. like Quantumania, it's a perfectly fine popcorn flick. But the problem is, it's the third movie in the Ant-Man series, and it directly follows up with Endgame, and it's not telling a story in a shared universe anymore. It's a sequel to everything that came before. In my mind, Marvel's biggest mistake was after Endgame, they shouldn't have touched a character in Endgame again.
Yes,
maybe Spider-Man, because they were contractually obligated to do so, and also that's just delivering giant bags of money to your house. But they should have done what they did with Iron Man, Thor, Cap. They should have done standalone movies for about another 2 or 3 years. They should have taken the hit in terms of the box office that would have been there, and they should have focused in on individual characters, Fantastic Four, the mutants, that sort of thing, and they should have built it up. And that's what I'm worried about with X-Men. I'm worried they're going to screw up X-Men, because I'm worried that they're going to make an X-Men movie. And I think if you want to make X-Men into a success, you should follow the same format that you did with Avengers, which is the most important X-Men should have their own individual stories before you bring them all together.
Yeah, like one of my favorite Marvel movies was Logan, and that's just literally about like two X-Men, and it's just really a really interesting story and a good movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the, I mean, Logan has been one of the high points of comic book movies that had not been released by Marvel in the last few years, and that's because despite their missteps, Fox actually gave a crap about the X-Men to an extent. The second attempt at the Phoenix movie was not good. Anyway, sorry, this is not a comic book podcast, but I just got off on a little tangent there. So, hey, everyone.
I was going to say I agree with the general idea that I like the world-building aspects of making additional projects, be they superhero movies or video games, that are not direct sequels but take place in a shared universe. Zelda is a maybe somewhat famous example of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
They're kind of sequels, but you do just kind of, you can totally disregard all of that. You don't have to listen to all the lore historians and just...
You don't have to read the Hyrule timeline.
No. I think the Hyrule timeline... Josh, I don't know if this is accepted belief online or not in terms of the Zelda fandom, but my personal belief was that Breath of the Wild sort of sorted out the Zelda timeline. I kind of like the idea that all timelines converge on Breath of the Wild.
That, yeah, is not totally confirmed. It is very, very common popular theory. I believe the only official word is it takes place at Breath of the Wild, that is, takes place at the end of one of the timelines. But they didn't tell us which one. And it is more than 10,000 years removed from anything else we know. So it's all kind of irrelevant which one that's at the end of. When you like to put like putting that in perspective is like the pyramids were built 5,000 years ago in our time. So you think about 10,000 years ago, it's just like, you know, at that point, just wipe the earth
clean.
Who's
to say what happened 10,000 years ago?
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
But I mean, not to get too spoilery or anything, but Tears of the Kingdom kind of even throws that into question, making you wonder if the whole thing isn't on the existing timeline at all. or again, if it's really so far removed, maybe it's 50,000 years at that point, and it's just like Hyrule had to be completely refounded from scratch, and for some reason they still called it Hyrule.
Yeah, it did have to be refounded from scratch. That's why they had to build the train.
Well, that was a different new Hyrule in a different timeline. A previous time.
Anyway, let's wrap this up now. I want to thank you both for joining me today on today's episode. I had a lot of fun. Good games, interesting games today. And we often talk about interesting games on this podcast. So if you wish to support us here at Random Encounter, you can listen to some of our prior episodes. Last week, for example, we had a special episode that was focused entirely on the series Mystery Dungeon. I think that the Mystery Dungeon Primer is going to be out by the time this episode comes out. I'm not sure. If not, it will be coming out soon after. We also have other podcasts here at RPG Fan. We have Retro Encounter. And last week, we did a Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth spoiler cast, which I highly recommend listening to if you like hearing me geek out about Yakuza, which if you're listening to this podcast, you really have to, because why would you be still listening to this podcast? Because God knows, I geek out about Yakuza nonstop. We also have Rhythm Encounter, which is RPG Fan's music podcast, and last week was Level 1 RPG Beginnings, focused on, well, exactly that, the Level 1 in RPGs. Great, great music there. There are other ways to support us, of course, and one of the best ones is to visit our shop. So if you want to go to www.rpgfan.com/shop, you can check out everything we have there. We have lots of things, like I've mentioned them here before. We have phone cases and magnets and t-shirts and things like that. But we also have our review card collection, which was published in collaboration with Hyperplay RPG. And that is a collection of the review cards that we publish on Instagram that are like little mini versions of reviews. There's nearly 300 of them in that review card collection. I love mine. I think it's a really, really cool little book. I highly recommend checking it out. It's just a really good little reference if you want to be able to flip through and find little capsule reviews of RPGs. I think it's really cool. If you'd like to get in contact with us here at Random Encounter, you can do so at podcast@rpgfan.com. I'd love to hear from you. If you have any ideas for like discussion questions, things like that, please fire me off a message. If you'd like to send me an email directly, you can do so at jlogan@rpgfan.com. But you can also find me on Mastodon at johnolgan@mastodon.social. I am not the only person on this podcast with a social media presence. Josh, where can we find you online?
You can follow me on Threads and Instagram. I'm Watcher Joshua. I pretty much only share what video games I'm playing, which for the foreseeable future will be Unicorn Overlord screenshots. And it's where I'll announce my inevitable Spirit Tracks fan game.
Sorry. And Alex, where can we find you online?
You can just email me at alexfranicek@gmail.com.
Cool. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends to help us get the word out there. And please, you can rate us on iTunes or your other podcast player of choice. And you could also leave us some reviews. Again, Alex, Josh, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it, as always. And appreciate the amount of work that both of you put in to RPG Fan. It's both of these, the review and the feature, they're really, really great. You'll find those links in the show notes, and or just go to the website itself and take a look around. There's lots of content on there.
Yeah, always fun.
Lovely. And to everyone out there listening, whatever you're playing, have fun.